Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Jolson.
Hi everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. I'm going to make another appeal for financial support from my listeners. Things have gone from bad to worse with me. I lost my job teaching at the college here locally. My contract wasn't renewed. There's health problems, tax problems. This will get resolved. One day this will get resolved. I do need your assistance. Many people ask for financial assistance even just without there being any problems. And I've never asked for it before. Prior to this situation of mine, I refused to ask for money. I gave away everything for free. And that was something that I was very proud of. When I was financially stable, I gave money all over the place. I gave money to many suffering nationalists around the country. And this is what we do. And then when I'm stable again, I'll continue to do it. I ask you to give through PayPal. There's one here on Radio Aryan and also on my website, rusjournal.org. That's rusjournal.org. Please help. I would appreciate it. Anyway, I want to talk about someone today that I keep meaning to do and I keep forgetting about. It's one of the great royal saints of the Russian Orthodox Church. The jurisdiction that I'm a part of, the Metropolitan Damascene of Moscow. This synod is the only synod that's canonized Tsar Paul I. There's all Tsar Paul. There's only been one Paul. He is immediately following Catherine the Great, and so he's already in a bad position. He's disliked very much by his mother, and she favors her grandson Alexander the First far more. Catherine the Second did not rule absolutely. This is a falsehood that almost every Russian history textbook will tell you. The Charter of the Nobility gave nobles a special status in Russia. They weren't serving anymore. The Charter of the Nobility gave nobles all of their privileges without any responsibilities. It completely upset the balance. Serfdom, up until that point, had been at least tolerable. In the 18th century, nothing was tolerable in Russia. The church had been purged. The line of the emperors had been broken. But at least there was a certain balance where serfs would serve the landlord. The landlord was then forced to serve the state. So it made a certain amount of sense. Now, serfs are forced to serve a landlord who then doesn't serve anybody. This was a problem. Tsar Paul will completely remove this and nullify it, which will probably be his death sentence. The nobles in Russia, the noble class, were deeply Masonic by 1800. He is murdered in 1801. They were deeply Masonic, those especially in the upper nobles, that men who had 20,000, 30,000 serfs. They worked their serfs very, very hard because they had a taste for Western luxuries. This was the big sin here. This was a big problem in Russian life, is that prior to Peter, Western goods, Western luxuries, that way of life was very little known. The wants and the needs of your typical landlord were very limited. That changed. But now they're being worked harder than ever. Serfdom prior to Peter, prior to the 18th century, really wasn't serfdom in any negative sense. Let's keep something straight here. Serfdom was put into place by Tsar Alexis because, and this is a post-Time of Troubles thing, so the early part of Tsar Alexis's reign, he began to realize that large landlords were taking labor from small landlords. The Time of Troubles had completely turned Russia on its head. It was rebuilding. If he didn't take that action, Russia would be drifting slowly even more into oligarchy. I said on this show and my writings many times before, the Russian noble class was deeply corrupt, especially at its upper levels. The only thing that kept it in tune was the monarch, forcing them to serve the common good, whether it be in the state, the military, the bureaucracy of some kind. Their service is what made the system go. And they would use any excuse to avoid any kind of service. And Paul was absolutely aghast at the charter of the nobility from Catherine and reinstated their service, which was something that absolutely outraged them. But serfdom initially was not a problem. It simply meant that peasants were guaranteed land. Serfs were never bought and sold. The land was bought and sold with the serfs already on it. The land was theirs. And they always viewed it that way. They existed in very powerful communes. It wasn't like, you know, you read the American history book and Russian history, and it sounds like these are individual serfs dealing with this all-powerful landlord. Nothing at all. That wasn't the case in the least. These were long-standing communes that the head of the commune then dealt with the landlord's men and came to a contractual agreement. That's how this worked. And then the commune itself would divide the labor dues. Now, in the 18th century, that began to become intolerable. As Western waves invaded Russia, as the nobles became more and more Westernized, they weren't even speaking Russian. After a while, they were speaking French, sometimes German. They looked down on their Russian peasant yokels. And they saw them as hicks that could be manipulated and destroyed at will. They were recasting themselves. It's really hard to enslave your own people. So in Poland, you know, the ruling class called themselves Sarmatians, you know, warrior conquerors from a different, you know, from the Caucasus Mountains, who imposed themselves onto the local Poles. They created a whole myth of their origins as being different, that the Polish noble was a race all to itself, separate from the serfs that they owned. In Russia, at the same time, serfdom became harsher and harsher. In the 18th century, Russian nobles began speaking different languages. They were slowly rejecting Orthodoxy. I mean, there were certainly some, you know, plenty of pious ones, but Freemasonry, brought in by Tsar Peter, who himself was a Mason, and then afterwards under the rule of Lord Byron, a foreign domination of the Russian society, who was also a Mason. The Lodz actually ruled Russia directly in that period of time. After the so-called Catherine the First, who was completely illegitimate, was drunk all the time. She died of cirrhosis of the liver. This was Peter the Great's last spitting on Russia. Lord Byron and a German group of Freemasons essentially took over the country, and they stole everything that wasn't nailed down. They destroyed the church. Entire counties in Russia were bereft of any bishop or priest. Peter had purged it. Peter had purged the bishop of every major city in Russia by the time he died. Some he tortured to death personally. You know, he was a demonic man. And if you've heard of some of these tortures that he devised, breaking somebody on the wheel, he would do this to pious bishops. And the fact that he was, you know, he was a Satanist in the Masonic Lodge, and of course in his famous unholy drunken synod, which he created, he took that very seriously. Some of you know he wrote hymns to Dionysius, and he had processions in the streets where he'd spit at Orthodox people. This is what Peter the Great was. And it's very, very easy to verify the nature of this unholy drunken synod. It was his utter hatred towards the Orthodox Church and everything that had to do with old Moscow. And it was, you know, undisputable evidence that he had been initiated into the lodge. This is what Paul had inherited. Paul was the first, other than Elizabeth, Peter's daughter. You didn't have any pious monarchs in Russia. The bond between peasant and royal house had been broken. And Lord Byron, in his absolute rapacity, completely destroyed and you know, just raped the country. There were only a handful of bishops left at a certain point. The synod was a way that the state could shut the church down if it wanted to. So let's keep in mind the Bolsheviks were not the first to attempt to destroy the church. Peter did, and Byron and many of his compatriots from Germany also did. Elizabeth was a respite that the church received. Catherine was absolutely no better. Catherine despised the church. And it was not until Paul I, really, that you had a substantial Orthodox man taking over, and he was attempting to heal a broken Russia. A Russia where serfdom was absolutely out of control, where nobles ruled completely. You know, the charter of the nobility meant that the monarch was not absolute anymore. We talk about absolute monarchy. We're not so much talking about that a monarch can do whatever they please. That was never the case. Absolute monarchy meant that the oligarchs simply couldn't rule the country as they please. That's what that means. With the Charter of the Nobility, the oligarchy continued to grow in power. And depending on whether or not they had favor with Catherine II, they could rule with greater or lesser power. And locally, they had tremendous power. The Charter essentially was a perverse version of the Magna Carta. And it gave them, and of course, property and their wealth was the only thing that really mattered to them. And of course, trial by their peers, meaning that their friends would be trying them. So it was a noble rule that was absolutely perverse. And the most important thing to realize, well, several things. Serfdom was extremely harsh at this point. It was not before. The country was absolutely broke. The church had been devastated. And most importantly, the bond between the average Russian person, the peasant or townsman, and the crown was broken. Paul takes it upon himself to fix this problem. Now, if you read any textbook in Russian history, Paul is depicted in the worst possible terms. And you're at a point now, really, where whenever the average history book and really any topic says anything and it uses harsh language to describe something, you know it's probably false. Paul is generally depicted as a bizarre, mentally ill, again, that phrase is used quite often, a dictator who did nothing but march soldiers in starched uniforms days on end for no purpose other than his own amusement and power. The chilling figure of Paul, which is another phrase that's been used before. And mentally ill is a common way to describe him. Of course, none of this is true. Tsar Paul was martyred by the Freemasonic Lodge with direct British assistance in 1801, because the first thing that Paul does is revoke the Charter of the Nobility. In order to justify his murder, they then created this story that he was insane, that he was unbalanced, that he was demonic, that he in fact was Masonic, when in fact he had banned the lodge. The lodge was quite free. With charter of the nobility meant that the Masonic lodges exploded, because the noble salons were the place that really they had a they had their germination period. But in revoking that, he's essentially banning the Masonic lodge, and he does himself explicitly ban the lodge. That's so that's a 1-2 punch against the noble classes, and this is why they killed him. As soon as they killed him, they installed Alexander the First, and they invented these stories. Now the British government was deeply involved in this, and in fact, even through their ambassador, they had a ship waiting on the Neva in case they failed. The conspirators would be spirited off to Great Britain. Rapin and Rapushkin, these were the main, they're both Masons and high-ranking nobles that were behind the murder. Members of the court. But there's no reason to believe at all that Paul was unbalanced. His tutors growing up, his governors, for example, Ponin and many others, they all had diaries, and they recorded nothing that could suggest that there's anything wrong with him. There's too many reasons to believe that he was actually a very effective and very intelligent ruler, one of the best rulers Russia ever had. But his rule was cut very short. He only ruled a few years. And I'm not the only one who says this, but had he continued a normal length of reign here, he wasn't that old when they killed him, he would have freed the serfs. He had to tread very carefully with the serfs, because that possession of serfs was really, in practical terms, what a noble title meant at that time. Which really shows you the perversion of the charter of the nobility, because once they were freed, they could do as they pleased, and they began making their own rules. And over time, the ownership of serfs meant that you were a noble. And so if you had serfs, that's what you were. I said on this show before that when the peasant uprising in Ukraine, the Hadamak rebellion took place, Catherine and her advisors sided with Poland. And they send troops to put down the rebellion after the Treaty of Andrusovo. And Catherine made it very clear that the Catholic elites have their power over their Russian serfs from God. And it's comments like that where you know that she was not an Orthodox person whatsoever. And so she brutally crushed that rebellion again. And Polish and the Polish method of dealing with Polish nobles owned serfs personally. Or at least that's how it eventually developed, what it became later. It was never meant to be that way. And the same thing was happening in Russia. By the time Paul came to the throne, serfs were being traded as people. It was no different from slavery, and this was an outrage. This wasn't what... No Christian has the right to own another one. There's nothing remotely in Russian tradition like this. This was slavery. They were breaking up families. The initial purpose, the real reason for serfdom was very clear. And its origin was a very positive thing. It protected small landowners, and it gave peasants guaranteed land and a guaranteed living. It was not a bad thing at all. And of course, they were self-governed. It wasn't like, especially back then, they could call the local cops and have rebellion put down. There was no such entity. Often nobles would have their private armies. Sometimes there were serfs that were members. So things were a lot more complicated than you might read in a history book. But things had gotten absolutely out of control. The Russians were imitating their Polish, being a noble, whether it be Polish or Russia, was far more important than being Orthodox. They had more in common with a noble from Poland or Germany than they did their own peasants. That was not the case prior to Peter the Great, prior to the 18th century. you'll hear that Paul executed all these people and sent thousands, I've heard as many as 30,000, to Siberia for no reason. In terms of verifiability, there were 10 people total that were exiled to Siberia. All of them were tried, and they were all basically theft or bribery cases. And remember, when you got exiled to Siberia back then, it was not that big of a deal. There were no prisons. It's not like that, but there was a prison waiting for them out there. They simply were kicked out of the country for a while. Most of these guys were able to leave eventually. It wasn't like a prison system where you had to line up and get your food. It was nothing like that at all. There was no prison there. They were simply kept under, essentially was house arrest, way far away so they couldn't be involved in the day-to-day politics of the society. It wasn't that big of a deal. And they all left. They all eventually escaped. And the hope was that, well, things blew over, so when they see me again, it won't be a big deal. That's exactly what happened. So Paul does a few things right off the bat. He says that at an absolute maximum, a serf cannot work more than 3 days for the landlord. He can work a maximum of 3 days, and the rest of the time was his. Sunday labor was absolutely banned. That's the first thing. The second thing is that he made it possible for serfs to complain against the landlords. He had an iron box, the famous iron box at his estate at Kachina, where anybody can put a petition in, and he read it. And he, just like Alexis before him, he read every single petition, no matter how long it took. The same thing in the army. Soldiers were able to complain against their officers. He came into power rejecting the elite of the society. He saw them as weak. He saw them as profligate. He saw them as promiscuous. He saw them as anything but true nobles. But by the time Catherine died, the noble class was really a sick, very, very pale expression of what they really were and what they were initially meant to be. And governors had to enforce the three-day rule, and then make sure that if there were any retaliation for any complaint, that was never done. And governors were under strict, local governors were under strict instructions to do this. This was a major attack on serfdom. He would have freed the serfs eventually, but because it was so close to what a noble was back then, he had to be really careful. He knew that his life was in danger at all times. The minute he did this, he revokes the charter. He makes it possible for serfs to complain, giving them a certain amount of power in society for the first time, and equality with nobles, at least in access to him. He became the peasant czar for the first time. Peasants were people. Well, in old Russia, of course, they were people. But the westernized, Europeanized Russia, they weren't anymore. And the Charter of Nobility meant that you could do whatever you want to these people. You could gamble them away. And Paul completely abandoned all that. And he was pretty certain, I guess, at this point, that he could be killed at any time. And he rushed through a lot of legislation with the understanding that he probably will be killed. The poll tax instituted by Peter the Great, there were tremendous arrears. Peasant poverty was a severe problem, and all tax arrears were forgiven. And this is something that outraged the elites as well. He fixed noble service. Now, in revoking the charter of the nobility, it meant that nobles now had to serve the state again. They had no choice. Upon reaching a certain age, they had to be educated. They had to be uneducated, at least in the area where they were going to serve. It was usually military, but it wasn't necessarily always. 20 years, an absolute minimum of service for a noble when he reaches 17 or 18. This is a part of being a member of a noble class. You can have serfs and things like that if you treat them well, but you have to pay for that. And you pay for that with state service and military service. he dismissed more than half of the officers in the army. This is because most of them weren't really officers. These were people who had appointments just because they were wealthy. And this was, you had this all over Europe, really. But he was tired of this. And it was well known. This is the case all over. It's the case in France as well. And he made certain that there were standardized training for these people. That an officer had to actually be a military man, not just a rich person who would send cannon fodder off into battle. A real army officer had to be a true military man and a true patriot, and someone who was doing service for the common good. Paper money was burnt. Fiat currency was out of the question for him. Now, it was always on a standard of some kind prior to Paul. But he hated the idea of paper money. He hated the idea of inflation. And so very early on in his reign, he took, God, millions of the paper rubles and he burnt them. And he said, no more is this legal tender in the empire. Instead, he began coining gold and silver, coins with a fixed value. Again, outraging the noble elites. Now, one of the things that Paul is accused of quite often is this constant drilling of soldiers. And it's often interpreted that he was just obsessed with it. He loved the power that he had over soldiers. And he gave them new uniforms and everything else. And he was very excited about that. And he was like a child, very disturbed and very, very much a tormentor. Well, a few things have to be kept in mind. In peacetime, Russian officers really didn't have much to do. They weren't training. They weren't really involved in military matters. So they were involved in economics. They were involved in commerce. They became like any other noble. Standardized uniforms were not the case at the time. So his obsession with uniforms was the creation of standardization in the army for the first time. And in drilling his men, it kept them away from the cities and exploitation and gambling and everything else they had a tendency to do in peacetime. It wasn't like, you know, today where you have military men going to the academy or something like that, and they come out and they're officers and they have a certain patriotic spirit. Well, not in America, you know, but elsewhere. That's not the case then. These were wealthy nobles who were able to buy their ranks. And those people were gone. And they had to serve in other ways. So they were humiliated, as they should be, and forced to serve in some other capacity. They couldn't go home. You know, you can buy your way anywhere. And some of the 10 people that he sent to Siberia were like this. You know, they used, you know, bribery and you know, they used their positions for theft. And it didn't take them long to realize that either we have to listen to them or kill them. And because of all of this, he developed the first state budget in Russian history. There will be, in the 18th century especially, things had gotten so profligate. The theft was a normal way of, you can't even call it theft, because it was simply the normal way of doing things. Peasants were mercilessly exploited. The army was used, you know, in useless wars. And Paul had enough of it. This is where the Pugachev Rebellion came from. Paul was sympathetic to the old belief. Unlike everyone who came before him, he was pious. He was a deeply mystical man. He was dedicated to the Orthodox Church. None of the 18th century monarchs, even Care Catherine I, didn't even know what it was. You know, she wasn't sober long enough. She was so riddled with venereal disease and everything else. It was such a mockery on Russia. Anyone who I still cringe anytime I see the Moscow Patriarchate has this on the Sunday of Orthodoxy. All the right believing monarchs, Peter I, Catherine I. I want to vomit on these people. Peter I, they don't realize he's a Mason. They condemn Freemasons right in the same thing. And Catherine I. It's a mockery of the office to even dare mentioning her. She didn't know where she was. he was a way that Peter could mock the Russian monarchy. Another thing is these cold cases. The Senate was created by Peter as a modern governing body, which had potential. It wasn't necessarily a bad thing, but it served largely as a Supreme Court. And because of these intense corruption and incompetence, it had a backlog of cases that no one had any intention of getting to. He forced them to go through these cases and come to a decision. They were not expecting this. So the Senate, everyone had to serve. By the time Paul comes into office, Russia is dying. Russia, no one was serving anybody. It was had become extremely decadent. And the Senate had absolutely no intention of going through these cases. So he's forcing everyone to work. He's removing those who didn't want to. And for the first time in ages, he's actually drilling soldiers and giving standardized uniforms and insisting on training and is supporting peasant life. He knew that his days were numbered, and he was aware of that. There were prophecies at the time that he wasn't going to make it. It's not an exaggeration to say that Paul restored the autocracy. It restored the absolute rule that kept Russia from becoming an oligarchy. And very soon, a conspiracy was hatched with the British government under the St. Petersburg governor, Palin. Was the main ringleader, and these were all generally high-ranking Masons, and they looked to England for assistance. The ambassador was Charles Whitworth, who was on orders from London to get rid of Tsar Paul. Now this is because he had sided with Napoleon. He was vehemently against the French Revolution. And it sided with Britain early on for that reason. But then when Napoleon had taken over, he saw this as a rejection of the revolution. For better or for worse, he saw Napoleon as a new beginning. He didn't see Napoleon as a revolutionary. He saw him as a restorationist of some kind. Now, he may have been wrong on that. But he saw Napoleon as someone to admire, especially in contrast to what had come before. Because of that, he turned vehemently on Great Britain. And for the first time, and this is very rare in Russian history, he had supported the Austrian Empire as well. Initially, he favored the coalition opposing the French Revolution, and then Napoleon takes over, and then he then sees Great Britain as the leader of liberalism in Europe. And so he backs Napoleon along with the Austro-Hungarian Empire and now sees London as the problem. The elite had always been, oligarchs had always been close with the British Empire. And that's when, as soon as they got this financial support and diplomatic support from the ambassador in Great Britain, that's when they decided to act. So it was a foreign policy matter, but also, even back then, Russia growing again, focused again, competently led again for the first time, was a threat to British interests. And the same thing has gone on ever since. And from that moment on, Great Britain was dedicated to destroying Russia. And not for a moment did they deviate from that. This was the beginning of that obsession with the British Empire. When Paul backed Napoleon, and then Napoleon sought to hit the British Empire in India. That was not Paul's idea, that was Napoleon's idea. And people often forget he's called crazy because he wanted to conquer India with the Cossacks. And everyone's supposed to laugh at that. Forgetting that was Napoleon's idea, and that a major force was going to be built to go after the British Empire and hit them in India, and even using local victims of their colonial regime to assist them. It's not a crazy concept. that was the heart of the empire abroad. And again, that gave all the more reason for Britain to want him dead. So now you had a very powerful coalition of people who wanted him gone. Paul was well aware that his days were numbered. He rejected the French Revolution and liberalism in general because he saw it as based on abstraction. The British Parliament at the time of the English Civil War invented this new concept, something called the people. It didn't refer to every individual alive in England at the time. That phrase, and it continues to be used today as if it refers to something. The people is an abstraction. It refers to our supporters. Because if you're not supportive of the Parliament, you love tyrants, and there must be something wrong with you. It was just this abstraction, whether it be the market or the people or these abstract rights that didn't take context or the common good into consideration. He rejected it vehemently. Now, Paul, well-educated, he spoke almost all European languages. He rejected the concept of the French Revolution on those ideological grounds. That doesn't make sense. It was so obviously a way to free the elite to rule the country, in the sense that an abstract right to freedom of speech sounds great until you realize that those with a lot of money can actually use that right, where people like me and you are pretty useless. No one cares what we say. But if we're Warren Buffett, everyone cares what we say. We're equals in that sense. We're equals in our freedom of assembly, you know, which is ridiculous because we're anything but equals. So these are false abstractions. They're meant to sound like this is this universal love of all mankind, when in fact it really does nothing more than privilege a handful of those who actually take advantage of these rights. Now, Paul did demand that there is no punishment without a strict trial. Again, this is something that had existed in Russia from the very beginning, but had fallen, became more arbitrary under Catherine. And for the nobles, even there, he was willing to let them have a trial of their peers. Peasant matters were usually done at the commune level anyway. And so he did support that. He was able to give them that. And it's not so much, you know, it's peers in America, it's just pretty much any living adult, which is ridiculous. Again, it's another false abstraction, trial of your peers. Now, peers meant members of your social class, people who had the same outlook as you, people who might even, for that reason, view you positively. So if they convict you, you really must have done something wrong. A trial by your peers removes any chance of there being bias, because we're pretty much biased in your favor. Members of your social class, your occupational group, that's what that means. It doesn't mean just any breathing person. You know, if I go on trial tomorrow, those aren't my peers, not by any stretch of the imagination. We don't even speak the same language. But the trial of the peers was something that the nobles loved because it meant that their friends would be judging them, and they would never create precedent where someone's property could be taken. They could use it, however, to plunder the property of their enemies. So it's an abstraction, but an abstraction that may in certain cases have a place, and therefore Paul was willing to give it to them. He took over the crusading order of Malta with Napoleon. This was at the time, this was not a Masonic order, this was an anti-Masonic crusading order. And he saw it as a means to rebuild the church. He saw it as something that he could introduce basic rules and orders of chivalry in Russian society. This is one aspect of the medieval West that he loved. And he thought that Russians, as he's beginning to reform the army and reforming the civil service, that an order of chivalry makes a lot of sense. An order of chivalry was something that would confront the Freemasons, which are anything but an order of chivalry. Every once in a while, someone says that the Maltese Cross is this Masonic entity. Well, it might be so today, I don't know. But at the time, it was anything but that. Paul had banned the Masons in Russia. One of the things that got him killed, and did nothing Masonic in his legislation, so he clearly is anything but a Freemason. He saw the Order of Malta as a way to bring society to Russia that wasn't an underground secret society. It was a chivalric order that then could create purpose. The nobility could have a way of training, a way of thinking. They had become so decadent under Catherine and so fearful after the Pugachev Rebellion that that they were useless. He saw the Order of Malta as a way to rebuild the nobility in his image, as a serving crusading order, as a way to fight revolution, as a way to fight liberalism, as a way to fight Freemasonry. And this is one of the reasons, you know, he was martyred. But he's also, this is one of the reasons he was canonized. Because, you know, his whole world was to remake old Russia, but for modern times. You know, this wasn't 1400. He realized this. The modern age had clearly dawned in Russia. There was nothing he could do about that. Western influence was there, but it wasn't necessarily all evil. That's ridiculous overreaction. Medieval concepts of chivalry are things that most of us find very attractive. And he saw that as a way to reform the nobles. And whenever you force that group to not only, you know, treat their serfs well, to be educated, to serve the state and everything else, you're going to make enemies. And now he's trying to change how they train and how they think and everything else. And again, it was just a matter of time. The plot was, and by the way, the knowledge of Paul's murder was kept secret until 1905. And this is something it's a separate issue. But that Paul was murdered by these noble Masons was something that was kept under wraps for a long time. It was simply, it was something that wasn't talked about in polite society. It was said that he died in a fit of epilepsy, apoplexy really, and he had a hemorrhage or a aneurysm of some kind, and that's what killed him. Rather than this very sordid, sordid murder of the monarch. He abolished conscription. Again, this has everything to do with bringing the chivalric orders into Russia. He wanted a professional military. Conscription meant that these noble leaders can simply throw bodies at a problem. He saw, even at the court, sometimes he was attacked for how austere his court was. Well, under Catherine and people prior to her, the court was overwhelmed with luxury, with tremendous expense, with complete decadence. This is not an Orthodox court. It was not an Orthodox court in the 18th century at all. There was nothing Orthodox about the elite in Russia in the 18th century. This is something that Russian nationalists all over the place are going to have to deal with, and they're not dealing with it right now. They just want to avoid it. Everything was fine until the Bolsheviks took over. That's not true. You had revolutionaries on the throne. Peter I was a self-described revolutionary. Catherine, to a lesser extent, was a self-described revolutionary. You know, these weren't Orthodox people. They rejected the Orthodox faith in every way. I mean, they may have gone through the motions of being baptized and everything, but that's meaningless. You splash water on somebody, that's not what we mean. There's nothing in their outlook or in the legislation that suggests that they were Orthodox people. This is not what they were. His spiritual father was Metropolitan Platon, who himself had reformed the seminaries. People often forget, and including Russian nationalists, Russian monarchists often forget, that's how bad Russia was by the time Paul took over. The church was a shadow of its former self. All the wrong people were placed in office, usually with state sponsorship. Because of what Peter did to pretty much every city that had a bishop in Russia, bishops were scared to death. After what Catherine did to Arseniy Matveyevich and putting him in that coffin and letting him die there for protesting the complete... Remember, at the time, the church had no property. They were totally secularized by this point. So they were put on very low state salaries, and part of the purpose there was to starve them, where it became really impossible for them to function. Parish priests were then the very lowest element in society because they were very poor. They really didn't have much time to be priests because they didn't have really much of a salary, so they had to work like everybody else. They weren't seen as somehow separate. You know, it's a positive thing that they had to work and they were like everybody else. That's true, but they also had sacred functions they couldn't get to. The church was attacked at this time in so many different areas. Some of it deliberate, some of it not. But Paul saw this and saw it as an absolute outrage. And you see how it's all connected. The assaults on the church, attacks on the monarchy, the secularization of church property, extreme levels of the exploitation of serfs, the changing in attitudes from a traditionalist to a liberal point of view, increasing local commerce by officers and nobles who really were charging rents. We say commerce, it wasn't exactly a market. Because of their power, they were able to charge rents. So when they got involved in commerce, essentially it's usury just built in. And you know, at that when you're a military officer, when you're a bureaucrat, you get to set prices. So to rectify this, Paul, among many other things, began setting up what were the first peasant land bank. It wasn't an institution like you had under Alexander III. Some of it was with his own money. He needed to restore the dignity of the peasantry. He needed to start giving small loans to peasants, then forgive them later on. All the old taxes were forgiven, as I mentioned. He needed to reconstitute the whole country. Confidence in the crown slowly but surely came back. If it wasn't for Paul, the very great things that the Russian monarchy did in the 19th century would have been impossible. He restored very slowly and painstakingly the trust between the peasantry and the crown. This is why it was so imperative that no one knows that he was murdered, because every peasant would have known exactly what was going on. He was murdered because he liked us. And you see another Pugachev again. It should be no surprise to you to learn that he legalized the old believers. He allowed them, including gave some of his own money, to support the restoration of some of their churches. Even that was outrageous because nobles involved in commerce, quote unquote, now had to deal with some of Russia's best businessmen who were old believers. I'm telling you, if it wasn't for the old believers, commerce would be entirely Jewish by 1900. You know, and we're talking about actual commerce here. We're not talking about rent seeking. By 1850, 1870, especially in the western part of the country, commerce was either Jewish or old believer. The old believers had a tremendous knack for this, and they didn't make profits. Whatever money they made over and above their expenses went back into the community. They'd be expelled if that wasn't the case. These were not rich people. No matter how successful they became, the community is who benefited. And this is why Metropolitan Platon was the first to create a new union, the Innoveria, the bringing the old believers back to the Russian church without having to change anything. They didn't have to. They used the old books, they used the old ways of life, they had their own churches, communities, everything else. They just commemorated the state church, which most of them did not avail themselves of. However, they were still legalized, briefly. And that changed later on. But the old believers were the peasant religion. By the time Paul, well, after the destruction of Pugachev, you know, Pugachev showed just how powerful the Old Believers were in the peasantry. There were tens of millions. It's been said that without state control, the entire peasantry would have gone to the Old Belief. And there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing, you know, the Old Belief is strict Orthodox. They're the true Orthodox of their day. I've always been very sympathetic to it. You know, I have a book out on the subject. They are the best of old Russia. They preserved old Russia. People don't realize how bad things had become. Your typical noble salon, even your seminaries at the time, things were done in Latin. Things were done in a Western scholastic way, not even a good scholastic way, a formulaic scholastic way. Even Platon was a victim of this. But he slowly but was with Paul, attempting to mix the best of the Byzantine style with the best of the Western style. But Latin remained the language of seminary instruction right up until the revolution. You would never find this amongst the Old Belief. These are the things that kept the Old Belief so popular amongst the peasantry. The Latin, this was a foreign imposition that nobles loved to set themselves apart from the rest of Russians. People don't realize how bad iconography had become strictly Florentine and Italian. You see some of the modernist stuff. Only the Old Believers maintained the three-barred cross. Sorry, the eight-barred cross. In 2017, the Orthodox Church has, you know, reclaimed all that. But at the time, that wasn't the case. They were becoming extremely Latinized. And people don't realize just to what extent that was the case. Bringing the Old Believers back was a way to admit their error. And by reclaiming their, well, by the very fact that they were legal and could function and even receive state subsidies in some cases, the state was admitting that they were wrong. But it wasn't until the post-revolution where the church underground had revoked all of the church anathemas on the Old Belief, which should give you a little sense of what an anathema is. Be excommunicated, be kicked out of the church. Well, sometimes it's good, sometimes it's not. You know, obviously the anathemas on the Old Belief that existed for hundreds of years tore the country apart. Well, we were all wrong. We're sorry. It wasn't until 1971 the Moscow Patriarchate had to admit that. Well, an apology, you know, that's no good unless you can make it good, unless you could fix it. Yeah, we're sorry that we persecuted you for hundreds of years. But the Old Belief was old Russia in more than one way. They were old Russia in terms of their view of economics and community. They were old Russia in that they preserved not just the old rite, but the old iconography and the old way of life. Look at the cathedrals of St. Petersburg. Look at St. Isaac. That doesn't look like an Orthodox church to me. Look at the old iconography in there. That's not traditional iconography. You know, it looks like the American Congressional Building with a few icons around it. They even, you know, Peter and his successors wanted to get away from the domes. They wanted everything to be Latinized, just with an Orthodox liturgy. And that's where things were. And then, of course, being so frightened of the Pugachev Rebellion, which was an Old Believer Rebellion, overwhelmingly, in the Cossack Rebellion. The Cossacks were all believers anyway. This just drove the nobles further and further away from old Russia. So Paul had an extraordinary amount of work to do. And when he was finally murdered, and just a few years into his reign, he had accomplished a huge amount. He's one of the greatest leaders in Russian history. And he doesn't get the attention that he gets, partially because of his short reign, partially because of the British propaganda campaign that he was crazy and that he was bizarre and eccentric and everything. I was going to go to the Wikipedia page, and it says purported eccentricity. I mean, they're aware that, you know, these things probably aren't true, but 30 years ago it was taken as absolute gospel truth that this is, you know, Paul was insane. Um, So he takes over, and he sees Russia now an oligarchy. He sees serfdom, you know, a perversion. He sees the court in absolute decadent luxury, not an orthodox court whatsoever. He restored the autocracy. He restored old Russia as much as humanly possible. Controlling the nobles became the preoccupation of czars from him on, from Paul onward. Alexander III could do it very well. Nicholas could do it very well. Nicholas II could not. That's no fault of his own. Noble classes, the princes in Russia, were very, very powerful, and they always were. They may not have been as powerful as they were. They weren't as relevant as they were anymore. But they had access to the halls of power in general. And here's one last thing. He permitted the synod of the Russian Orthodox Church to elect the Oberprocurator. That nullified Peter's Masonic, the so-called reform of the church. What Peter had done is created this so-called collegial system where the bishops would meet, and Peter and his successors would impose an Oberprocurator, a president of the synod. Sometimes these guys were Masons, atheists, materialists. That was done quite purposely. Nothing could be done or approved without the okay of this guy. Sometimes they were very good. Pope Donatius was one for a while. But Paul, for his reign, said the synod should be able to elect this man. So in one fell swoop, he gave the church autonomy again. This is a slow but sure movement to even restoring the Patriarchate. And again, had he lived, I believe he would have done that. He would have been the Tsar Liberator. He's the first one to pass pro-serf legislation. He created the precedent. And nobles, Great Britain, even those in the church who didn't want to be reformed were at war with him. Like all great leaders, he was surrounded with traitors. No one wants to work. No one wants to be forced into a new mold. No one wants to serve the common good. They want to serve themselves. You have an arrogant noble class, not even Christian anymore, used to serving themselves and helping themselves to the state finances whenever they pleased, now being forced to serve and to be educated and to, you know, banning the Masonic lodges. So the big area of their power was removed. And the state budget meant they couldn't simply take from the state whenever they wanted. He purged the military. He ended conscription to create this new professional military class. His time was limited. They strangled him to death. And knowing full well how popular he was amongst the peasantry, they absolutely had to keep him, keep that fact under wraps. It was a nasty sort of thing to do to a man. So from 1796 to 1801, he was able to create this tremendous level of reform. But it was 1801, it was March 26th, Count von Palen, who actually was military governor, as I said, of the area, breaks in. Paul had realized something was going on. He had tried to escape. They found him and they strangled him with a scarf. That was kept from the population. So when a group of Freemasonic conspirators, who are very wealthy with very, very close ties to Great Britain, kills you, you know that he's a good guy. That alone. So he is a new martyr. He was a lover of the church. He was a lover of the peasantry. He was a lover of old Russia. Nothing that the monarchy accomplished in the 19th century could have been done without him. The pro-serf legislation, none of that developed later on. Nicholas I began it. And then, of course, his successor, Alexander II, finished it. It all had essentially Paul's backing. And he was the one who put it into motion. He was a great man and a great ruler, and it just showed you how power was operating there at the time. He was able to make Russia great again, and he did. Russia would be unrecognizable today without Paul I. And other synods, other jurisdictions of the Orthodox Church need to canonize him, as my bishops have done, because he deserves it more than anybody else. Again, I ask my friends, supporters, to assist me financially, to donate to the Orthodox Nationalists, however much they can. And in the meantime, thank you for listening. I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalists with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson at RadioArian.com.